Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a really deep cut across three very distinct geopolitical and legal arenas.
Yeah, it's quite a spread.
We're talking high-stakes strategy for ending a major war, then shifting to, well, the normalization of authoritarianism quite close to the EU, and finally, a legal tangle right inside the EU's own foreign policy machine.
That's right. And our mission really is to pull out the key strategic and legal thinking from these sources we've got. The common thread, you know, is how international structures, the UN, NATO, the EU treaties themselves are used, or maybe misused, to handle tough political fights and deploy leverage. Yeah. And these aren't just analyses of what's wrong. There are some, frankly, audacious proposals in here for solutions, things we really need to get into.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Mm-hmm. Starting with what sounds like the boldest play here, this idea of using the Balkans to force a breakthrough in Ukraine.
Uh-huh.
The core concept seems to be targeting Putin's known fixation, almost a legalistic one, on Serbia and Kosovo, using that to push for a ceasefire in Ukraine. Is that roughly it?
That's the essence of it, yeah. And the linkage is, well, pretty sophisticated. The proposal suggests Kyiv and Moscow would agree on an interim setup for the Donbas based specifically on UN Security Council Resolution 1244.
1244. That's the Kosovo resolution from 99, right? The one Russia actually backed at the time.
Exactly. The very same resolution that governed Kosovo after the NATO intervention.
Okay, but if 1244 is the model, how does using a decades-old UN resolution, one that ultimately paved the way for Kosovo's independence, actually help Kyiv? Doesn't that sound like a massive political minefield for President Zelensky?
It absolutely carries risk, no question. But it might be more appealing than other options because, crucially, 1244 sidesteps the immediate sovereignty question. It sets up a temporary, purely provisional UN administration. The final status is pushed down the road based on the will of the people. And for Kyiv, the immediate win is huge. It instantly stops the intensive Russification drive. No more forced Russian passports, property grabs stop, the military indoctrination of kids ends, the UN, or maybe the OSCE, would step in to manage the territory. They'd set up property commissions, help refugees return. It halts the erasure of Ukrainian identity there.
Right, that makes sense as a benefit for Kyiv. But what's the real pull for Moscow? Why would Putin accept a UN or OSCE presence that actively stops Russification?
Well, because the 1244 model does something else instantly. It severs Kyiv's exercise of even symbolic sovereignty over the Donbas right now. And perhaps more importantly, it feeds directly into Putin's documented legalistic approach. He's consistently pushed for strict adherence to 1244 regarding Kosovo. And remember, he used the Kosovo precedent, however controversially, to justify annexing Crimea in 2014 and recognizing Donbas in 22.
So it gives him a kind of ready-made UN-stamped justification or off-ramp.
Exactly. A framework he himself has previously, in a different context, championed. And the deal would involve agreeing up front on a key principle. No return to the pre-war situation for Donbas. Then they'd explicitly outline potential end states like partition, maybe union with Russia, or reintegration with Ukraine, but those would be decided by future referenda.
Right.
And critically, displaced people and refugees would have the right to vote in those referenda.
I see. So Putin gets a framework he can spin legally. Ukraine stops the immediate bleeding in terms of identity and control on the ground.
Yeah.
But where's the leverage, the diplomatic muscle to actually make this happen?
That comes from the other half of the proposal. The simultaneous, really decisive move proposed for the Balkans itself, offering both Serbia and Kosovo membership in NATO.
Wow. Okay, that is the political earthquake.
Uh-huh.
Because the whole Russia-Serbia relationship hinges on Moscow blocking Kosovo's independence at the UN, right?
Yeah.
Keeping Kosovo isolated is Vucic's absolute top foreign policy goal in Serbia.
Precisely. So bringing Serbia into NATO, Russia's oldest ally in Europe, really would be a massive geopolitical shock to Moscow and Beijing, too. It shatters Serbia's long-held neutrality. It basically forces Belgrade to finally, really accept the outcomes of the wars in the 90s.
Okay, but why would Vucic ever agree to join NATO? What are the carrots and sticks here?
The proposal points to two very specific things. First, apparently, the current U.S. president enjoys unusually high popularity in Serbia. He might be one of the few figures who could sell NATO membership domestically.
Interesting.
Second, and this is the stick, the U.S. signals readiness to enforce sanctions on NIS, the Serbian National Oil Company. Gazprom Neft owns a big chunk of it.
Hitting the economic nerve.
Right. It forces Belgrade into a corner,
Choose
the relationship with Russia, or face serious economic pain. It could even push them towards nationalizing NIS to get out from under the Russian ownership issue.
And what's in it for Kosovo? They get NATO membership, which is huge for them?
Mm-hmm. It's everything for them. They're alpha and omega, as the source puts it. That pathway to NATO is seen as the incentive powerful enough to convince even hardliners like Albin Kurti to finally establish the Association of Serb Majority Municipalities.
Which is the thing Serbia has demanded for years.
Exactly. But crucially, Kosovo would do it without Serbia having to formally recognize Kosovo's independence.
So Vucic gets the association, Kurti gets the NATO path, and formal recognition stays off the table for now. A really complex trade-off.
It's a very intricate swap, yeah. Trading long-term strategic ambitions for immediate political necessities on both sides.
And for the U.S. and NATO, the thinking is, what? Low risk, high reward in the Balkans.
Pretty much. The risk of expanding there is seen as minimal. I mean, the region's landlocked, surrounded by NATO countries, far from Russia's landmass. This move would stabilize the region, take it off the board as a playground for Russian meddling, and potentially allow NATO and U.S. troops who are currently there protecting Kosovo to draw down.
It frees up resources.
Right. So it connects these two seemingly separate conflicts with this quite extraordinary diplomatic maneuver.
Truly audacious, as you said. Okay, that's the external strategy. Now let's shift gears dramatically and look inward towards the EU's neighborhood, Georgia. A very different kind of crisis brewing there.
Yes, a story of democratic backsliding becoming, well, normalized. The municipal elections on October 4th, 2025, really just confirmed the trend. The ruling Georgian Dream Party, GD, won literally all 64 municipalities.
All of them,
cementing total one-party rule at the local level. This follows the disputed parliamentary elections back in 2024.
And this wasn't just a political victory. The sources describe it as a managed spectacle, right? Designed to brush off Western criticism.
Absolutely. The playbook was pretty blatant. Prime Minister Kobakidze called international monitors, like the main OSCE mission, ODIHR, unnecessary. Then they issued this last-minute invitation less than a month before the vote. That effectively made any meaningful, large-scale observation impossible.
And then they used the lack of proper monitoring to claim Western bias when concerns were inevitably raised. Clever, in a cynical way.
Very. And domestically, they tightened the screws. Key local election watchdogs, ISF Fed and GYLA, had their bank accounts frozen. They ended up boycotting the vote. Meanwhile, the opposition parties were systematically weakened, leaders jailed, internal splits encouraged. Many of the pro-European parties just refused to participate, calling it a farce.
And the actual results, when you look closely, it tells a story, doesn't it?
It really does. It's about control, not popular enthusiasm. Mm. In the capital, Tbilisi, the GD mayor, Kaladze, officially won over 70%. Sounds huge.
Right.
But turnout absolutely cratered, down to just 31%. In 2021, it was nearly 50%. So that huge 70% win, it actually represents maybe only a fifth of all registered voters.
A hollow mandate dressed up as a landslide. It's quite the piece of political theater.
It is. And this all played out against a backdrop of ongoing daily pro-European street protests since 2024. The organizers, feeling increasingly desperate, called for a peaceful revolution on election day, October 4th.
How did that go?
Predictably, perhaps. A small group tried to get into the presidential palace courtyard. Riot police moved in immediately, dispersed them, arrested the organizers, and now they're facing charges of attempting to overthrow the government.
And Georgian Dream's reaction wasn't exactly conciliatory, I gather.
Not at all. Kobakidze doubled down. No talk of dialogue. Instead, he promised an even broader crackdown, vowing to finish off the opposition. They're using that incident at the palace as the perfect pretext to basically criminalize any serious political dissent.
And this includes ramping up the anti-Western rhetoric, too.
Massively. Kobakidze actually accused the EU ambassador to Georgia, Pawe Herjiski, of being personally involved in this supposed coup attempt.
Seriously, accusing the EU ambassador?
Yes. It's a calculated move, right, to paint Western partners not as allies supporting democracy, but as foreign agents trying to destabilize the country. That justifies more repression domestically.
And Europe's response to all this sounds muted.
Dangerously so, according to these sources. Brussels puts out statements, expresses concern, but no real consequences. The internal EU debate about targeted sanctions or even suspending Georgia's visa-free travel access has just stalled. Member states are divided, there's strategic fatigue.
So GD gets the message that Europe's red lines aren't really red.
It seems that way. They feel they can normalize this kind of managed authoritarianism, even as an EU candidate country, without paying a significant price.
Are there any factors keeping GD afloat other than just repression?
Yes, and it's important to note this. GD's grip isn't just based on cracking down. The Georgian economy has actually been booming, 7.9% GDP growth reported, average salaries up over 10%.
Okay, so people feel better off economically.
That certainly helps make the anti-Western narrative more palatable for some. Combine that with the opposition's struggles, they remain divided, unable to sustain those really large-scale, decisive protests needed to force change. It leads to a kind of public apathy.
Right, a complex picture.
Okay, let's connect this now. You mentioned the challenge of internal obstructionism within the EU itself, mirroring this erosion in Georgia.
Exactly. The difficulty the EU has in acting decisively on Georgia relates directly to its own internal decision-making problems, especially on foreign policy and sanctions.
So we're shifting from the problem of external inaction, like in Georgia's case, to a problem of internal paralysis within the EU. The famous Orbán problem, the veto weapon.
That's a big part of it, yeah. Hungary, under Orbán, has become very adept at using the unanimity requirement in the Common Foreign and Security Policy, the CFSP. They use the veto, or the threat of it, as political blackmail, holding up essential things like renewing sanctions on Russia unless they get concessions on totally unrelated issues, like unlocking frozen EU funds for Hungary.
And this works because of how the EU's own rules are being applied or misapplied. Precisely. It boils down to how two key treaty articles are handled. Theoretically, you have Article 29 of the Treaty on European Union. That's where the Council defines the overall approach or strategy, say, deciding to sanction Russia. This requires unanimity. Then you have Article 215 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the EU. This is meant for the implementation, the detailed regulations, who exactly gets sanctioned, what trade is banned. And this step should be decided by qualified majority voting, QMV. No single veto.
But that's the theory. What's happening in reality?
In reality, the two steps have basically collapsed into one. The Article 29 decisions, which need unanimity, have become incredibly detailed. They spell out almost everything. So the Article 215 regulations, the ones that are supposed to be QMV, end up just rubber stamping or copying the hyper-detailed Article 29 decision.
Got it. So the unanimity requirement from the first step effectively bleeds into the second, neutralizing the whole point of having QMV for implementation. And that gives one country huge leverage.
Exactly right. It magnifies the power of a single veto exponentially.
So the fix being proposed sounds almost deceptively simple. Go back to the original design.
That's the core idea. Adopt leaner council decisions under Article 29. These decisions should focus only on the absolute essentials, the overall goal of the sanctions, the criteria for listing someone or something, and the general sectors or areas being targeted. Keep it strategic.
Right. And then all the nuts and bolts, the specific names, the detailed trade rules, the licensing procedures, all that stuff.
It's pushed into the Article 215 regulation, where it can be decided by QMV, as the treaty's intended. You separate the high-level political agreement from the technical implementation.
Makes sense. Is there anything else to this proposed fix?
Yes. One other crucial element, getting rid of blank sunset clauses.
What are those exactly?
These are clauses often included in sanctions packages that say they automatically expire after, say, 6 months or a year, unless unanimously renewed.
Ah, so they build the veto opportunity right back in again and again.
Precisely. It guarantees the obstructionist player gets another bite at the apple every time renewal comes up. The proposal is to replace these with concrete evidence-based conditions for review or removal. Like, sanctions stay in place until certain objective benchmarks are met or specific criteria for delisting someone are fulfilled. No more automatic expiration requiring a unanimous vote to continue.
Okay, that sounds legally sensible. But how do you actually get this change through politically? How do you convince member states, especially Hungary, to agree to a process that reduces their veto power?
It's not about a big bang reform. The idea is a more gradual procedural path. The High Representative for Foreign Affairs, working with the European Commission, which actually drafts most sanctions proposals now, can start nudging things. They begin presenting progressively leaner Article 29 proposals to the Council, make the strategic decisions simple and harder to object to on spurious grounds. By doing that, they push more and more of the contentious detail into the Article 215 implementing stage where QMV applies. It makes it harder for a single state to hold the whole thing hostage over minor technical points. It's about slowly reasserting the original legal balance through practice.
A political strategy using procedural means.
Oh.
Okay. So wrapping this all up, what does this mean for you, our listener? We've journeyed through a really audacious strategic proposal linking the Balkans and Ukraine, looked at the grim reality of democratic decline in Georgia, and the consequences of the EU seeming unable or unwilling to act forcefully, and then explored a potential legal fix for the EU's internal gridlock on sanctions.
And what really stands out from these sources, I think, is this persistent theme, trying to use complex legal and geopolitical tools, whether it's a UN resolution like 1244, the strategic expansion of NATO, or reinterpreting the EU's own treaties to solve really hard, deeply political problems. The constant challenge is getting the political will to actually match up with the potential offered by these legal and institutional structures.
So, in a world where we see figures like Putin or even Orban within the EU selectively using legal arguments or democratic rhetoric to advance their own agendas, what's the takeaway here? Which approach ultimately offers a more durable path forward for the West? Is it the kind of bold, high-risk, high-reward diplomatic gamble we see proposed for the Balkans, betting on massive strategic leverage?
Or is it the other path, the perhaps more tedious incremental work of reasserting constitutional norms and fixing internal procedures like the EU sanctions proposal suggests? Diplomatic audacity versus procedural resilience. It's a tough question.